Welcome to Las Vegas Sun Politics on KUNV. I'm Michael Squires, politics editor at the Sun. Bill Raggio, the lion of the state Senate, died last week. We'll talk about his legacy of 38 years in the legislature. Nevada has added jobs for the first time since 2007. What does that mean for the upcoming political season? But first, we'll pay more for water after the Water Authority approved a rate increase today. We'll talk about how controversy over the increase might lead to some changes. And joining us to discuss these and other issues are David McGrath Schwartz, who covers politics in the state capitol, and Joe Shaneman,
who covers Michael.
Clark County. And we promise no talk of Laughlin over the next 30 minutes. Welcome to both of you. Joe, let's start with you. You were at this Water Authority vote. Like I said, they approved it. But there was some talk of I guess, 3 years down the road when there might be another increase of getting a committee together to study things. What do they want to look at?
It's more of a committee of people with pitchforks and torches. No, it's one of the county commissioners. See, this was a wholesale price increase. Now the wholesalers go to the individual water districts, which are the retailers, essentially. And the retailers have to...
i.e. the Las Vegas Valley Water District.
Las Vegas Valley Water District, Henderson Water District, all these other things. They have to sell this to their water users. Commissioner Chris June Kiliani said that she is going to get a committee together and very quickly come up with an alternative plan to the $5 per residential rate, per residence surcharge. I think it's $31 for retailers and, I don't know, $1,000 or a couple thousand for large businesses. And she's going to come up. She was huddling together with Las Vegas Chamber of Commerce people during the meeting. She thinks she's going to get enough parties together. She told me she could throw everybody into a room. She's done it before, and after a day or two, come out with a solution that's different than this flat rate and which might be more equitable.
Okay, so as we said, you're according to the Water Authority's plan, residential users get a $5 surcharge on their bill. A business would see likely a $36 increase, and then the resorts will see a $2,200 increase. What she's looking at, now the chamber, you mentioned the chamber, they have been opposed to this, saying that residential customers and the resorts are getting off easy and that it's causing some of their bills to go up maybe up to 300%, are some of the figures they've cited. What could they do, I guess, to figure out a different way of doing this, and would it affect the Water Authority's plan? They need to raise this money to pay off their bonds.
It's a good question. The chamber last week said they wanted essentially a $10 flat rate increase for residential because they believe that's the fair share that homeowners should pay, which would decrease the amount that businesses, small and relatively large, would have to pay. How it would affect the casinos, I mean, the casinos are getting off in this whole thing pretty scot-free.
Some people are wondering why that is, because if it went by, if we're in a flat charge and instead a per 1,000-gallon charge, they would see it go up because they use so much water. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, they would see it go up. It would, the percent, the figure, I can't remember the figure that somebody showed me, but if it was a pay-as-you-go as a per gallon of usage, it would go up, but it probably wouldn't go up. It would go up a higher percent than the 2 to 6% that the casinos are going to pay under this flat rate, but I can't remember the exact figure.
So one thing that I'm curious about, though, is this: you mentioned that the Water Authority is the wholesaler, the water districts, Henderson, Las Vegas, etc., are the retailers. They can come up with their own structure. They can say, "We'll raise the money for you, but we'll do it this way. We'll charge only,
Yeah, it's sort of interesting. It sort of makes me think the Water Authority should just say, this is how much money you need to raise and do it your own way instead of going through these different options. But they can now, I mean, I don't know how many are going to do this because they have to have it done by April. That's very little time. And the county commission is voting on it 8 o'clock Tuesday morning.
And the county commission voting on it in what regard?
As they're in their capacity as the Las Vegas Valley Water District, they're supposed to vote on it. I think Chris is going to try to get enough support to form a committee to see if they can come up with alternatives within 4 weeks to meet the April deadline.
Now, some people saw this vote as an opening, some of the critics, I guess you would call them, of the Water Authority, some of the spending. some people criticize the building that they have downtown. That's that high rise, I guess.
It's the Mulaski, yeah. The Mulaski building. And in fact, they have what I was told. The Water Authority rents out 4 or 5 floors. 4 of those floors are now empty. So one of the Water Authority members was saying, you know, sublease these to somebody, do something to make money, because they pay roughly $4 million a year in lease payments.
But at that rate, we're just probably nibbling around the edges, because the big bill is this $3 billion for the third straw into Lake Mead.
It is. It is nibbling around the corners, but it is a symbolic gesture that the politicians feel.
Symbiology
is very important, because although the Water Authority says we cut, I can't remember if it's thousands of jobs, they actually haven't laid off anybody. What they've done is not, if people quit or retired, they haven't filled those positions. Nobody's been specifically laid off. And as one county employee told me, they have plenty of employees over there right now.
Now, one of the interesting things to come out of the discussion also is that in the heyday, during the boom years, they were getting so much of their money from these connection fees. So you build, if you're a developer, you throw up a housing development, all the connections for those homes to the water system would each bring money in the door at the Water Authority. And that in the heyday, 57% of their expenses were covered with these connection fees. At their height, they were $188 million. They've now dropped to, or in 2010, dropped to $3 million. I believe last year they were at about $11
million. Nobody's arguing. They need the money.
Right.
Let me just interject here with a question for you, Michael. How do you flatter a girl from Wisconsin, where I'm from?
I don't know, Joe. Please.
Tell her nice tooth. That's a sop to you Laughlinites.
Yes, sops all around. But coming back to this, like you say, people aren't disputing that the money's needed. Is anyone questioning that third straw, though, with the lake level having risen a bit in the last year?
Not really. I mean, they at the end of the meeting today, they said they expect the water level to Lake Mead to fall 13 feet next year, due to what looks like 77% on average of snowfall on the western slopes of the Rocky Mountains at this point. So the third straw was needed because there's two straws already there. One's at a high level, one's at a mid-level, and this one's at a very low level. And if the lake gets down far enough, the first straw, the one at the top, could be sucking air after a while. The third straw at the bottom is really an assurance measure. In case the lake gets so low, there will still be a pipeline into the lake that will supply water to water users. Nobody's arguing that it's needed. They think, you know, this. Who knows if the drought's over? It's reassurance.
You're listening to Las Vegas on Politics on KUNV. I'm Michael Squires, and we're talking with Joe Shaneman, who covers Clark County, and David McGrath Schwartz, who covers the state capitol. David, Bill Raggio passed away last week, Thursday night. He was traveling in Australia with his wife and died there while they were traveling. He was in the legislature for 38 years. You talked about how we'll probably never see another Bill Raggio. Why is that?
Well, first of all, just, you know, we won't because of term limits. Senator Raggio served in the state Senate for 38 years. He had a long career in the Senate minority before becoming majority leader and holding that for most of the past 20, 30 years. And nowadays, with term limits, you get 12 years in the state Senate and you're out. You know, he and Joe Dini, who retired, and I believe 2003, you know, were the last of these long-serving legislators who wielded enormous power.
And what were some of the things that made the fact that they were in the legislature so long and in the legislature together for so long, how did that make things different than we see today?
You know, it's been described as an era of more collegiality, of more compromise, less partisanship, and certainly less bitter partisanship, where people now in the legislature will complain about constant campaigning and folks always angling towards the next election. You know, and let's be clear here that some of this stuff you always hear, but the reminiscences about the good old days, but, you know, people who look at this with a pretty clear eye say that things have changed. The parties have gotten more polarized, particularly Senator Raggio. When he was alive, he would talk a lot about how the Republican Party, he felt, drifted towards the right, towards what he saw as the extreme of anti-tax, uncompromising position there.
So, but Raggio in his own right could be polarizing at sometimes. Some within his own party were saying he was a rhino, with that acronym for Republican name only. What was his response to that? Because that's something you would hear a lot.
I mean, he points to pictures of, or he pointed when I interviewed him in his office a couple of years ago. He pointed to pictures of himself with Ronald Reagan, Dick Armey, other sort of what he called traditional Republicans, and that's how he viewed himself. He had a mantra of a state government that was lean but not mean, meaning that he did see a role for it in providing services. He was seen as a big advocate for higher education and for some social services, but also stuck to what he saw as traditional Republican ideals of low taxes, which he differentiated from what he sees as an effort to create no taxes and less regulation and having a small government.
Now he was a Reno Republican. For Southern Nevadans, he was sometimes a figure that represented the North's dominance over the South, even though the South had well outgrown it in population, and many thought should have outgrown it in power.
Yeah, and he was a major obstacle to Southern Nevadans getting what they considered to be their fair share. He was a big protector of UNR and the funding formula that gives more money to Northern colleges and essentially slaps down UNLV and College of Southern Nevada, and also of services. You know, he was very aware of Reno and where his constituents were.
Is that something he would acknowledge, or would he just say that there were other things at play?
No, I asked him about that, and he pushed back. He said, look, Southern Nevada might have the Strip, but it also sucks up a lot of services. We have to spend more money down there on different things. But in many ways, he was pretty unapologetic. The bridge from Carson to Reno was seen as a part of his legacy for right or wrong. This massive engineering feat of a series of bridges between Reno and Carson City going past the cows, otherwise known as my best friends in Northern Nevada. And, for good or bad, that in a lot of ways represented to a lot of people Senator Raggio's influence of the North.
Certainly the project that launched 1,000 op-ed pieces in a certain Southern Nevada.
The bridge isn't even open, right?
Not yet, no.
And that's been how many years? 10 years?
David, he's described as statesman, as kind of the consummate legislator, someone who could get the parties in the room and hammer out a deal, and who would know what everyone needed or wanted and be able to use that as leverage to get a deal. Is there anyone in the legislature now who can do something similar? Obviously, it would take years and years to develop that. There's probably not someone with that level of experience, but is Nevada going to have these kinds of figures in its legislature?
You know, we've had some impressive lawmakers, some smart lawmakers who did not certainly serve for 38 years. But right now with term limits, the leadership is just about completely turning over. Well, it is turning over in all four caucuses, the Democrats and the Republicans in the Assembly and the Senate. You're going to have new leaders there. And, you know, to be honest, I would call them untested at this point, to be charitable and to be less than charitable. These are folks that have not shined in past sessions. It's not saying that they can. It's an open question right now of what lawmakers are going to step up and, become leaders in this process.
You're looking at the Republicans having Michael Roberson, perhaps, as the majority leader in the state Senate.
Right.
He was a freshman last time.
He was very effective as sort of the Republican pugilist against the Senate majority leader last session, which was Stephen Horsford, the Democrat. But, you know, if Republicans hope to take the majority, can he be a majority leader? Can he lead the House? And that's an open question. Then you have Senator Dennis, who's the Democrat, likely going to be the head of that caucus. And some people have questioned, is he tough enough to go up against Senator Roberson? In the Assembly Democrats are going to have, it looks like Assemblyman Marcus Conklin is going to be the speaker. He's a Democrat from Las Vegas. He was majority leader last session. But there was an open fight within his caucus for the leadership post, first time in a long time that has happened. And then the Republican Assembly folks have such a small majority, they struggle to be relevant, you know, and they have probably the most established person with Pat Hickey, who's a assemblyman from Reno up there.
So what's the thing you'll remember most about Senator Raggio?
I remember walking his district. It was when he was running against Sharon Angle, and Sharon Angle was challenging him as not being conservative enough in the Republican primary. This is back in, what was it, 2008? It was the summer. It was August. He was 82 or something like that. And it struck me that, you know, he's this revered figure in the Republican Party, in the legislature. He's got a bronze bust at the Reno airport, all these buildings at the university named after him. And here he is in these old grandpa tennis shoes walking around his neighborhood knocking on doors. And to me, that sort of felt like something had shifted in the way that politics is conducted.
You're listening to Las Vegas Sun Politics on KUNV. We're talking with David McGrath Schwartz, who covers the state capitol for the Sun, and Joe Shaneman, who covers county government. David, you reported today that there was some, a glimmer of good news on the job front for the state of Nevada, that not since 2007 had the state been able to add jobs, and that happened last year, according to a state agency that tracks that. Is this, how good a news is this, I guess? Is this just a sign that things aren't going to get worse, or that they're actually getting better, or what?
Well, the way I described it before a certain unnamed editor took it out was a golf clap, you know, a little mild, measured applause for this news. What folks described it, economists I talked to and people who watch this, is the start of the anemic recovery. It's going to be a long, slow climb out of this recession for Nevada, but it does look like we hit bottom. Sometime in 2010, looking back, was probably sort of the nadir, and since then there haven't been great gains overall for the economy, but the bleeding has stopped, as they say.
And what did economists have to say about them? How quickly can an economy recover that's been in recession for that long?
We have some underlying problems with our economy, namely the housing market and the way that our economy was built. It was very reliant on gambling, of course, and that has come back. And that is doing better than the overall economy. That is propping up some parts of the economy. But the construction industry still lost jobs in 2011 compared to 2010. So that still looks like it's searching for its bottom. Excuse me. And then, you know, the residential construction market is going to be a huge burden for Nevada, and the foreclosure mess that we're in is going to be a suck on the amount of disposable income people have to spend.
Now, politically, Republicans, some people are accusing them of not wanting there to be good news on the economy. And some of their talking points have been circulating a bit in the media over the last week. And I thought this is a good opportunity to get into that. Three things that they say that they'll be emphasizing, if there is good news on some fronts, is the national debt, unemployment, and rising gas prices. I guess my question is, how will this play in Nevada, where we have been hit worse than anywhere else? Is there any question that the economy will be the top issue for every voter going to the poll?
It has to be. I can't see how it doesn't. And the Retailers Association released, there was a poll released this week that showed that President Obama is facing some trouble here. More people want to see someone else elected rather than President Obama reelected in Nevada. That has to be a sign of the bad economy. One of the interesting things, though, for me up here watching the governor as well is, you know, the governor is projecting optimism, and that's sort of been the cornerstone of his administration. And how will Republicans balance having a Republican governor who's trying to promote this sense that things are getting better, we're doing better, with a Democratic president who, you know, Republicans want to hang a bad economy around his neck?
So the question is, how do you say, oh, Governor Sandoval's doing a great job, but President Obama isn't, and have that jibe with the economic news here. You mentioned Governor Sandoval. He has this initiative. He wants to create 50,000 jobs by the end of 2014. The report that you had cited in your stories says that the state has lost about 175,000 jobs.
Right.
So we wouldn't really even be replacing what's been lost, and that the jobs that have been added take us to about the employment levels we were seeing in 2004.
Yeah.
Where does the 50,000 jobs that the governor is calling for get us back to 2006?
Somewhere around there. But we were growing at such a breakneck pace that in some ways we have to stop looking at that and expecting some type of quick rebound of gaining all those jobs back. And maybe I'm buying into the bugaboo of low expectations, but I mean, 50,000 jobs, I looked into that number. I asked some folks about that number, and they said that's about 2% growth per year, which, if it fits in with projections, is not wildly optimistic or Pollyanna, and it's also not unreasonably low, you know, to set the bar low, and so it's easy to jump over. You know, the 50,000 job number, you know, it'll be interesting to see what Governor Sandoval tries to take credit for, what he can take credit for, and what just sort of happens naturally as the economy slowly trudges its way back.
Well, someone turning down a job is the law firm of Lionel Sawyer and Collins. Joe Shamnan, you were reporting on this a few days ago, saying that they had won the bid for a big contract with University Medical Center. UMC is looking at a different type of governance, maybe turning into a kind of a nonprofit public hospital. Lionel Sawyer and Collins won the bid, but they turned it down. Why did they do that?
I think they wanted this victory, this bid winning, not to look like it was juiced in, because one of the attorneys representing them would be Rory Reed, former county commissioner. And when they won the bid, there was a lot of angst on the county commission board because the commissioner said they were never even apprised or told about this bid coming forward. In fact, when it went before the board, it was on what's called the consent agenda, which is an agenda that county staff believes is something that doesn't even need to be debated. It's just a given that they're going to all vote yes, until Commissioner Steve Sisolak pulled it off and said, you know, what is this? And when they started talking about it, the other, you know, Commissioner Lawrence Weekly, who's on the hospital, he's the chair of the hospital board of trustees, said he'd never even been, nobody even mentioned it to him. The county attorney said, well, she thought it was a legal county commission issue, not a hospital issue, which made no sense to nobody. And they voted, and Weekly didn't even vote on it. Lionel Sorensen Collins got it, but later Rory Reed told the commissioners they don't want it. They want it to go back, have the bid be reconsidered, And their bid was not the lowest bid either. But now, this was a professional services contract, which I was told means they do not have to consider the lowest bid. They can consider other things. However, in this economy, a low bid, in fact, one of the bids was about a third, two-thirds lower, is a very important aspect, and I don't know what's going to happen. It won't come up this Tuesday, but maybe in 2.5 weeks from now, it'll be back before the board.
I did a bad job explaining what they might be looking at, but one of the things would be to become a not-for-profit public benefit corporation, whatever that is. Yeah, however, that would be different from what they have now. But they're obviously looking at the massive financial losses over at UMC and some way to just minimize the financial impact on the county budget. How much are they losing? Is the county losing there every year? It was about $70 million at one point.
The county is throwing about $50 to $60 million, maybe up to $70 million at the hospital every year in addition to how it's already funded.
Okay, so they are going out looking for a law firm. You say it's a professional services contract, so they can say, well, even if you're the lowest bidder, we don't think you have what it takes to do this. Did Lionel Sawyer and Collins have what it took? And I guess the reason people are interested in this is because you mentioned Rory Reed's part of the firm. They are one of the heavy lobbyists up at the legislature, known as one of the firms with a lot of sway.
Yeah, they're good lobbyists. They have former Senator Richard Bryan, Rory. In fact, if you read their application, most of it reads like we're the best lobbyists, and they really are, which is making some commissioners think they should cut this contract in half. One part lobbyist, maybe that goes to Lionel Sawyer Collins, and the other part goes to a firm that really does this job well, and there is one firm out of Washington, D.C. that has done this many times for many other hospitals.
So they're looking at the lobbyist end of this would be that there needs to be some kind of change at the legislature that would allow UMC to make this shift to a public benefit corporation.
Yeah, some change in law that's, you know, some arcane knowledge that I'm sure Schwartz is all over.
I'm sure he loves it. And you say it doesn't come back Tuesday, but how quickly could we see something like that?
Oh, God, quickly. Yeah,
you got 10 seconds to answer. So
how quickly? You know, it'd be really fast. I don't know. I have no clue.
Joe Shaneman covers Clark County and sometimes knows the answers. David McGrath-Schwartz covers politics in the state capitol. You can follow their coverage and the rest of the Sun Politics team at lasvegassun.com.
Thank you, Michael.
/ politics. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, David.
Thank
Michael
you.
Squires, good night.